The thing is I didn't know he was going to free solo El Cap. It was just pitched as like a story, a film about Alex and his free soloing. In the process of kind of vetting the idea, my wife Chai was like, you know what? I need to spend some time with him and get to know him. And in the time that she spent with him, you know, she spent 2 days with him, and I was like, hey, what'd you think of Alex? She's like, he's very, very interesting. And by the way, he told me that he's going to go free solo El Cap. Isn't that great? Because Chai isn't from the climbing world. And she did not understand what that meant. And she said, that's a perfect, like, focal point for the film. And I just said, there's absolutely no way we can make that film. Introducing a camera to a situation, no matter who you are, even if you're Alex Honnold, changes the situation. And when the margins of success, that is the difference between life and death, are so thin that the idea of the camera being there or the pressure of a production around what he was doing was even for him, if he barely felt it, but if that was the amount that it took for things to go bad, I was like, I don't want to carry that responsibility. And funny enough, we let the cat out of the bag at a meeting with Nat Geo. And before we could even say anything, they were like, we'll finance that film. And I was like, actually, I'm not going to make that film.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. If this is your first, I'm so stoked for you because I am geeked. I'm flat out geeked on who we have on today. And by trade and training, I am a sport and performance psychologist. And the whole idea about this podcast, about the Finding Mastery podcast, is to learn from people who are flat out switched on, who have committed their life efforts towards exploring the boundaries of their own potential, and in doing so, end up shifting what we understand the potential of others. And I'm more fascinated and more interested in those that have a deep understanding of self and a deep commitment to mastery of craft. And so that's what this conversation is about today. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well, so be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. This week's conversation is with a legend, Jimmy Chin. And if you're not familiar with his work, I can't wait to introduce him to you. He's an Academy Award-winning filmmaker, National Geographic photographer, and a professional mountain sport athlete. He climbed, summited, and then skied off of Mount Everest. And then on top of that, like, that's cool. But that's just kind of where this story really begins. And he's made significant first ascents on all seven continents, including the coveted first ascent of the Shark's Fin on Mount Meru. And if you're not familiar with this mountain, this spine, Meru means spine. If you're not familiar with it, it's a sacred mountain. It's in the Himalayas in India. And in particular, there's a peak called the Shark's Fin. And it looks just like a shark's fin. And it is a massive granite slab that has been untamed, an untamed muse, if you will, for some of the legends in the climbing world. And that's dating back to Mug Stump's flat out legend and his first attempt in 1986. And then with another, 12 to 15 or so attempts, all of them falling short of summiting. This thing is radical. And so Jimmy documented it. And he documented his first attempt at summiting with two of his partners. And then in a radical turn of events, they ended up going back and waiting to see. You've got to see this documentary that he produced, Meru. You've got to see this. Seriously, you've got to see it. Now, all that being said, his latest documentary is Free Solo, featuring Alex Honnold. That won a BAFTA, 7 Primetime Emmys, and the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature in 2019. How about it? And if you're not familiar with Alex Honnold, literally, this is a documentary also you have to watch. And we interviewed Alex on the podcast, and so I encourage you to listen to that as well. And Jimmy's photographs have graced numerous covers of National Geographic and New York Times, fill in the blanks. It's amazing. His resume precedes itself, and I've been wanting to have this conversation for a long time, and I can't wait to share his insights, and I literally hope that something becomes a bit brighter for you, and I hope that you face some truths about where you hold back in your life. And we're going to get into it about risk, about chasing dreams, about unconventional paths. We're going to get into all of that. Okay, so with that, let's jump right into this conversation with the flat-out legend, Jimmy Chin. Jimmy, how are you?
Great. How are you?
Yeah, man. I've been looking forward to connecting with you for a long time. We had a great time surfing together. And yes. I'll tell you, man, that was a highlight day, wasn't it?
It was absolutely a highlight day. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, please. Yeah. Like, one, what you've done is remarkable. And I can't wait to roll up the sleeves and really understand how you work. And what I mean by that is, like, how do you use your mind? And you find yourself into some precarious situations, I'm sure, hanging off ledges. So we're gonna roll up into that.
All right. That for sure.
So let's start with this. Your reputation precedes this conversation. So as far as an introduction, I'd rather actually start at early life with you. And so what was it like growing up with your family?
Well, both my parents were from China, and they both experienced kind of a cultural revolution in China. So they both experienced some hardship going from China to Taiwan, where they, you know, spent a good amount of their lives before they ended up going to graduate school in the States. So just a little context. And they actually met in the States. Interestingly, my mom's side of the family was like a very progressive, you know, my grandfather was a Western trained doctor, and this is kind of funny, but my grandmother on my mom's side was an actress in Japanese cinema, and she spoke like three languages, and was, you know, so she came from this very like progressive family. And then my father came from the South. My mom came from the far north, north of Beijing, Harbin, and then my dad came from the far South, and he was like the opposite spectrum. Like, now that I have a better understanding of the world and probably politically, but also like a very kind of military background family. I don't think they would have ever gotten, you know, been a match in China, but because they met in the States, you know, there's probably not that many other Chinese options in like the late 60s at a graduate school in the States. I think that really kind of, you know, shaped my upbringing, because, and I see it in my day-to-day life, you know, just these two very different sides. Like, there was, my mom was always very creatively minded, wanted, you know, I started playing the violin when I was three, was always, you know, doing arts and crafts and drawing, and you know, was thinking about music and all these things that she wanted me to be exposed to. My dad was very tough, and, you know, had me studying martial arts from a very young age. It's the first thing I really remember doing with my dad, was like learning how to punch correctly. And like, there's a lot of the ethos of the martial arts kind of instilled in me. So I started martial arts at a very young age. And then I also swam competitively from a very young age through high school. But, and they were both very focused on my academics. One thread that was clear from both of them was, you know, they had very high expectations in everything that I did. So excellence was a big focus, also academically. And, you know, that's what I remember. I remember going to a lot of swim meets, a lot of martial arts competitions, playing in the orchestra. It was very structured. But as I was growing up, I found skiing, which was kind of like my thing. And we had this teeny little hill. You wouldn't think that, you know, growing up in Minnesota, there'd be much skiing, but, you know, I grew up in like a small university town in South Central Minnesota, and my parents were librarians. But skiing is this thing that I found that was kind of my thing. And when I did well and everything else, I got to go skiing. Something else though, having librarians as parents is I was fed a lot of books. And so I grew up reading a lot as well.
What was one of the main narratives? So it's excellence. I hear that. I hear exposure to much, you know, I hear that there was some structure that you got to, when, if you did your job well as a student, that you got to go play on the mountain or the yep. hill. And so what was some of the narratives that you're still carrying forward today And the double click underneath of that is, what are some of the narratives that you're trying to undo even right. still today, right? There's both sides of it. What are some of the yeah. ones that you're still carrying with you? And I mean that in an aspirational way. And then the other is like in a more heavy way, like I'm still trying to undo some of that early stuff.
Yeah, that's a very good way to approach this conversation, because it leads into something else, you know, into my 20s, which was a lot about undoing things. But I would say, especially now as a parent, you know, I have a daughter that's 7, Marina, and then my son, James, who's 5. I pay attention to a lot of, you know, what I'm trying to instill in my children. But I would say that, you know, I think it was probably somewhat predictable to have immigrant parents who wanted to create the best life they could, this new life in a new country with their kids. So trying to give me every single opportunity they could and expose me to everything that they could think of that would help, you know, develop me as a person. And, you know, that's something that I do with my children too. Like, I think it's great for them to have a lot of exposure. And just to give that whole thing a context too, is, you know, I'm married to Chai Vassarelli, and she's born and raised in Manhattan. And here I am living in Jackson, Wyoming. And I can't help but think, I'm like, wow, I couldn't have picked someone that was like further from my world than Chai. And so there is like some sort of kind of parallel with my parents. But what it means is that we expose the kids to a lot of different things. You know, Chai, it's like the New York Ballet and the Met, and, you know, and on my side, you know, they're surrounded by, you know, we split our time between Jackson and New York, you know, they're surrounded by mountains and outdoors, and pro skiers and pro snowboarders and pro surfers are like, you know, circling our house all the time. But I do really appreciate having like a big world presented to me. And, you know, I think that opened up my imagination to a lot of different worlds I could occupy. But ironically, when I was growing up, my parents were drilling into me that, you know, you could be a doctor, a lawyer, or go into finance, you know, and I literally thought there were 3 jobs in the world for a while, you know, like as much as they were. And I get it, you know, like, and it's a different time now too. It was certainly much more structured and traditional career paths then than there is now, but I didn't quite answer your question because you were asking,
what are you holding on to that you're trying to yeah. undo from early age? And what are you using that is propelling you forward in life?
Yeah. I mean, I think that exposure to a lot of different things is something that I still appreciate, but discipline was a big one. I understood from an early age to excel at anything, it required a lot of discipline and a lot of self-motivation. And if you really, really wanted to excel, it took a lot of focus and almost obsession to a certain degree. Like, you really had to go dig deep and, you know, persevere. And I think one of the hard things about it was it instilled a certain sense of fear of failure. And that is something that I've had to work on to undo, you know, where it's like, I've learned over the years, certainly now, that, you know, failure in a lot of ways is like the greatest way to progress, you know. Like, you can't be afraid to fail. Like, you want to fail fast and early and learn and embrace that potential. And, you know, I'm a perfectionist, so I often feel that pull of conflict where I'm like, I don't know if I want to go that far because, you know, I might fail, but then, you know, I've taken some fairly extraordinary risks in my life, and many of them have paid off for me. So it's been reinforced to undo that fear of failure that, you know, kind of I was set up for in a way.
Yeah, it sounds like that early structure and high need for achievement, and I might add in there the perfectionistic pieces that they were hinting at. But also, it sounded like the message was to be the best. And I'm wondering if you're still working to be the best or your best as just a kind of framework position. There's no right and wrong. There's costs. On both of them, there's costs. And if you're trying to be your best and you don't have a reference point about what is possible, period, then it becomes this really kind of garage band, naive, listen to me ripping. And then you open up the garage door and then you see U2s across the street, you know, in the other garage, you're like, oh, so until that point, it's kind of a naive game, right? Like, oh, yeah, that's what you can absolutely do with the drums. Yeah. So what are you trying to sort out? The best or your best?
Well, my best. And I now, like, I can look back to kind of continue the narrative from after I, you know, went to college essentially, and I came out of school, and there was like a huge expectation that I was going to follow a traditional career path. There was a lot of pressure. You know, my parents were librarians. They weren't like, you know, extraordinarily wealthy, but they had really taken their life savings and put it into my education and my sister's education. So there was that kind of pressure of like, what are you going to do with yourself now that we've spent our life savings pushing school?
Wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah. And I decided, I told my parents, I was like, look, I know this is what you want from me, but I had discovered climbing early on in college, and I was just completely enraptured with that idea, the lifestyle. In a lot of ways, it coalesced all of these skills that I had gotten through different things like swimming and like the training for swimming and endurance and pace and all those things, and martial arts, just like, you know, physical awareness and those kind of things. And then add this element of risk. And, you know, so I found this thing that I was deeply passionate about. And I told my parents, I was like, hey, look, I'm just going to take a year off and I'm going to climb and ski full time, and I'm going to get it out of my system. And then I'm going to focus on my career. And they're, of course, you know, mortified of this idea. But I went and did it. And that turned into 2 years, and then it turned into three. And then, you know, 7 years later, I'm like 28 and I'm still living in the back of a little Subaru hatchback, living in Yosemite, skiing in the ski seasons, doing odd jobs, waiting tables. In Jackson, I was like shoveling roofs, like of mansions, you know, because they needed rope work. And like, I was just valet parking. I was doing anything to kind of like keep the dream alive.
And Jimmy, what was the dream?
I just wanted to climb and ski and be in the mountains. And the part of the story that I think is important to note here is to answer your question is I remember distinctly thinking, it was the end of that first year, I thought, I can't not climb. Like, I'm gonna go back for another season in Yosemite. And I put it on myself, and I was like, if I'm gonna do that, I'm gonna be the best possible climber I can be. And I remember that I can be part is different than I'm gonna be the best climber in the world. It was more like, I'm gonna see how far I can take this. And I had a little, like an innate confidence in the fact that like, I knew what I was capable of if I really focused. Cause I understood what that meant. That meant training and just devoting everything to it.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to Hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydro.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. Jimmy, I think that this is really important because it's so trite to add, to say, you know, I'm trying to be my best and the best I can be. Like, I think you and I syncopate there completely. But when that is, I don't want to say obsession because you used it earlier, but when that is a reservoir that runs really deep and runs through everything that you're doing, especially the thing that feeds you the most, it becomes this widening of an aperture, to use your lens framework, widening of an aperture to see how far you can actually go into it. Because as soon as you start to have frameworks that constrict, you know, and create pressure in an unhealthy, consistent way, I think we run into real problems. And I'm betting that if it wasn't climbing, that happened to naturally feed you. But that, I want to figure out how I can be the best I can be at this. And you fill in the blank, whether it's photography or it's climbing or it's skiing, maybe it's all three, that was the part of the fuel, let alone the feeling that you got when you were ripping down a mountain or captured something beautiful. And wave me off if I'm not right on this.
No, it set the framework for really everything that I did. So whether that was photography and then eventually filmmaking, these were also things that I had no idea about. Like, I didn't grow up in a family where climbing or photography or filmmaking were, my mom used to say, of course we're worried about you. There's no word in Chinese for like what you're doing. There's no career in Chinese or a word for it, for what you're doing. Like these were things that I had discovered. And I never took a photography class and I never took a filmmaking class. You know, these were things that I discovered and that I was just like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm passionate about. I'm going to figure it out. And I'm going to see out of almost pure curiosity, like how far can I go with it? You know? And I would look around and I'd be like, okay, well, this is what other people are doing. Like, I think I could do that better by doing this, you know, like it, so it was very, it did open the aperture and really nothing, you know, kind of phased or intimidated me in that sense, because once I started having kind of this, I guess you'd say reinforcing of like, oh, you know, I'd have these breakthroughs all the time. I'd be like, okay, I want to climb El Cap in a day. You know, and then I would focus on it and then I'd do it and I'd be like, oh, that seemed absolutely absurd a month ago, you know, and, but by applying myself in these ways, you can figure it out and you can do it. And then, you know, that kind of evolved and I'm just talking about the climbing side. So I was like, okay, well now I'm climbing El Cap in a day. I want to climb a bunch of routes. But then I started thinking, but this is just Yosemite. Like this is only now a stepping stone, because really the next big level is taking what I learned here into the Karakoram, like high altitude alpine big walls. Like that's the pinnacle. I wonder what it takes to get there, you know? And I put together my first expedition to the Karakoram when I was, I think 23. And I had no idea how to put together an expedition. You know, like a really remote, logistically complex place. Like, and I just went and figured it out. But it was just from this, like, in some ways, it was like a curiosity. I kept being like, wow, that worked. Like, I wonder how far I can go with this, you know?
So if we pull on that thread just a bit, what were you trying? What were you chasing? Was it the bigger, the better? Was you chasing testing your capabilities? Were you chasing adrenaline? I don't get that from you.
No, I was mainly curious about, I mean, I guess in college, I studied international relations and I studied, comparative religion. I was really kind of, at some point early on in college, I was really like, looking at Eastern philosophy, but the base idea I came out of it with, and I don't know exactly how this formed, but I mean, there was a sense of urgency for me in terms of life. And like, I didn't necessarily use the words I'm about to say when I thought about it, but it's just that idea that like, time is our only true currency and you're only spending it. Like you don't get it back. And so if you want to look even beyond like this idea of, I wanted to discover what my capabilities are, more of it is related to this idea that, life is short and I want to make the most of it. I want to experience the most out of this life. And for me, that meant seeing how far I could go.
I don't want to be callous when I ask you this, so I'm going to couch it by saying that, but what you do comes with great physical risk. It can, you know, and actually we should sharpen it by saying what you do actually has consequence that could end your life or loved ones.
Yeah.
And so, is this accurate that it is a more painful life to live a life not knowing than it is to live a life at the edge in the amphitheaters that you want, doing what you want, but maybe dying earlier than the safe route?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do believe, I don't know how to exactly answer that in the in those words, but there's that part of me that is like, I can't not do this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a calling, as some people would say. That calling has evolved. Some of it is still the same at the heart, but you know, part of this my life experience is also on a lot of levels, you know, on the outside looks like it's all about like this physical risk, but you know, the craft of a lot of what I do is around managing risk, like those calculations, those decisions, the team you surround yourself with. And if you really look at my work, it's like managing risk. Like, how accurately can you assess risk? How accurately can you calculate it? That's a huge part of the process outside of like, you know, what is being seen superficially. You know, it's like, oh, he's climbing a mountain and it's like really hard and there's ice and there's all this stuff and he's got to be physically strong and technically capable. Like, there are all those aspects, but there's this other aspect for me that is also deeply satisfying, is like, you're not just going into these things without chasing adrenaline, you know? There's a creative aspect to it outside of like the film and photography that's also like creative problem solving and like understanding, you know, the risks, managing them, assessing them, building this like situational awareness that constantly expands the more experience you have, and being able to apply all these different things and ideas to be able to do this in a way that hopefully doesn't end up with you dying. You know, when those stakes get really high, it becomes very interesting. And there's a lot of self-reflection that's also involved with it. So these kind of experiences feel very deep for me because they're so all-encompassing.
You choose your words very deliberately. And I don't get a sense that you're editing for anyone else other than for the art of precision. But I want to just ask, like, how is your mind working even in this conversation? What are you doing quietly that nobody else is aware of?
I'm trying to be accurate.
And is that an intellectual exercise, or is it a heartfelt exercise? It's somewhere in between those two?
Well, it's probably both. A lot of the stories that I tell in the work that I do, and this has been a discovery and an evolution of thought for me, because when I originally started photographing the people around me, you know, they were really inspiring. And some of it hasn't evolved. Some of it is actually still the exact same. But I always found I had my own discoveries about these experiences and the people around me. There's always so many misperceptions or these ideas around some of these stories that I felt weren't true or accurate. But people still found them really interesting potentially. But I knew underneath it, I was like, if they really understood, then it becomes interesting, like really interesting. Then it becomes really inspiring. Like, the photo of this person climbing is like beautiful and inspiring, and you know, maybe we'll take somebody out of wherever they are and bring them into this moment. But when you start to dig into these stories, there's so much depth, and it can change people's perspectives. And I enjoy doing that, you know. And I like to do that, because it brings more depth to people's understanding of like the human condition, you know?
So is it fair to say, even in this conversation, but if you mapped it into life in general, one of the main themes that you're working on is the truthfulness, the honesty of the accuracy of an experience. Does that sound close?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially obviously in nonfiction filmmaking, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
It's something that I find these real life stories deeply inspired. Some of the motivation is because I'm really inspired, you know, and it's as if like the urge to share that because I'm excited about it is something that drives a lot of what I do. And, you know, if you look at kind of my body of work, photography or filmmaking, you know, there's a common theme about like the human potential and the human spirit. And, you know, what I try to bring are like universal ideas that people can relate to. But in the experiences and the places and the people that I'm with, those might on the outside seem very unrelatable.
Because they're so skilled and they're right on the edge.
Yeah, and it's so far from most people's reality. But yeah. to be able to like connect in a way to that, that for me is fun.
Right now, what do you wish people knew? Based on your life experiences, and sometimes it's really hard to get all of your good stuff out, right? But if right now, thin slice, moment in time, what do you wish people knew about potential, about capability, about life?
I mean, I feel like I'm so fortunate on a lot of levels because of the mentors in my life and the people that I have been able to spend time with. I've been able to work with many of the great adventurers, explorers, climbers, snowboarders, skiers, you know, of my generation. And on some levels, it's kind of all the same. Like, these are people who don't see boundaries, or if they see boundaries, they're just like, like, well, that's a great place marker because I'm just gonna go right through it. And I'm constantly inspired by the people I get to work with. And I think what I'm really saying is like the human potential is limitless, you know, in a way. It truly is, you know, whether that's in music or design or whatever it is, like I've seen it time and time again, where attitude and vision and, well, simply hard work, perseverance, hard work, determination, all those things, I've seen the impossible achieved over and over and over again. You know, not everything we got to make a documentary about in Free Solo, you know, but day-to-day things where, you know, someone will do an impossible trick on a snowboard that nobody's ever done before. Ski a line that nobody's ever done before, you know, had the vision and the right attitude to achieve the impossible. And I think history has many examples of that, but that's what I would say.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to aquatrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. Again, that's aquatrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. What does right attitude mean to you? It's a very Buddhist thing to say. Mm-hmm. Are you Buddhist?
I did study a lot of Buddhism, and there's certainly like a lot of philosophy, ideas within Buddhism that, you know, I apply in my own life. Mm-hmm. And I think attitude is one word. I mean, it's how people look at life, its perspective, how they choose to see the world. It could be really, really, you know, a lot of people can only see limits and challenges and impossibility. And then some people are just brush those aside and they're like, no, this is how I see it, you know? And the bigger and broader they can think, it's this exploration. And I always think about this idea of the word explorers, of people like exploring new territory or like a physical landscape, but like explorers are people who are like exploring, you know, the boundaries of like the human potential and their own potential. And so that attitude, I mean, means a lot of things.
That's awesome. I think when I hear you say exploring potential as opposed to the traditional exploring a frontier, like I do think the most exciting frontier is the one that is yet to be explored. And that for me is the internal stuff. And so exploring that, I mean, I'm I'm in company with people that have been philosophers for thousands of years saying, yeah, no kidding, dude. But it's so complicated and it's so beautiful. It's so complicated. And what I love about it is that right now is a really exciting time for psychology. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got folks like yourself, like some of your climbing partners, Alex and Noel being one of them, saying, yeah, what happens between my ears, like it matters, you know? Yeah. And yeah, a lot. And so, and then we've got traditional stick and ball athletes. We've got people across the planet right now recognizing the importance of the inner life and the skills that support a beautiful inner life, even when the external world around us is shifting sand underneath our feet. And it feels like it's really hard to be grounded in any kind of way. If you've got the right internal structure and skill set and ability to be strong and flexible at the same time, you can adjust. So that being said, what are some of the mental skills that you are, you hang your hat on? What are some of the ones for you that you're like, listen, thank goodness. And I had to learn, maybe you could tell a story about how you had to learn it. Maybe most of us have to learn things kind of the hard way.
Mental skills. I mean, it is, I totally understand what you're saying. I think, and this is something that I've become more aware of, and this has probably evolved over years and years, but there's also this aspect of the attitude, I guess, or perspective, where there's two pieces of it. One, I think, is intentionality, like having the vision and the idea and being willing to put it into the ether as a possibility.
Does that mean saying it to somebody else?
It can be, or it can be writing it down.
Okay.
I started noticing at one point, like I would write something in my journal and be like, this is where I want to be. And then it would happen. And so then I started purposely writing stuff in the journal and being like, but it was just that idea of like, oh yeah, you kind of have to identify where you're going in a way. But there's that intention behind it. And then there's the actual belief of what that intention can become. I think that's something I do all the time. It creates a certain, not confidence or overconfidence, but it does allow me to try things that seem really far out there. And I see that with a lot of the athletes I work with. You see that with great entrepreneurs or great musicians, you know, in a lot of different genres and worlds. The other part is just, and this might be paradoxical in the way that, but you can't also be attached to the outcome. A, because you never know where like that intentionality will lead you, because it could lead you totally in a different place that's still as extraordinary, more extraordinary than where you plan to go. But you have to love the process. Like it, and that's something else that I noticed. Like once you really embrace the process without like being attached to this outcome, and you drive into being in that moment, and like it, and sorry to use a like a terrible climbing metaphor, but it is, it's like every single step matters, or you can't get to the top, you know. It's like, and so the focus, although the intention needs to be placed, and it's important to have, I think, a broader view of where you're going, but you also have to bring it back and just be like, you know, in the moment and really focused on the process and hopefully love the process, you know, no matter how hard it is, like that hardship or the suffering, or like, it's all part of, you know, where you're going. And there's always, you know, something to be learned. But
when something matters to you, you'll do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And that's true for a loved one. That's true for an idea. It's true for a life that you want to live. If it matters, you will do what it takes. And I, people ask me all the time, like about sacrifice. I said, I don't know what you mean. Like I really don't understand the concept. And maybe it's because, I don't know. I haven't had enough suffering. You know, there's lots of ways that somebody could answer that for me, but really my approach, my attitude toward it is that no, I'm making choices. And these are choices that ladder up to my life purpose and what I think is possible if I really applied myself with the right people in my community to help. Maybe I didn't go to that party or I didn't go to this thing or I missed that thing over there. But it's like, hold on, I'm making some choices. I could go to those things if those mattered more. And this is where I get caught in my loop about, you know, selfishness. And because I've got people, my family, I love them. And sometimes I'm spending, and I think that you'll echo this, like sometimes I'm out on the frontier and it's like, that is hard for me, dude. I don't know how you do it, but that's hard for me.
It's one of the great challenges right now for me as a parent.
Yeah, how are you wrestling with it?
I mean, I think what you were talking about with choices and how you've been thinking about it, that's actually something that I have been thinking about quite a bit as well, in terms of, you know, there's the choices we make in our day-to-day and what could be conceived of as sacrifices or not sacrifices and fear of missing out and all that stuff. But that in like the choices of like how we even decide to look at this is also another choice, you know?
Yeah.
In some ways, I think it's very empowering to recognize that, because a lot of people become victims to themselves, you know, if they don't make the choice to look at it, like you just discussed, like, oh, woe is me. Why is my life like this? Or I missed that party and I'm just going to dwell on it. Or I missed seeing this thing because I made another choice. Like, but just knowing, you know, you are in control of your choices. You are in control of how you deal with the situation. You're in control of, you know, how you feel. I'm saying that knowing very well that I don't feel like that all the time.
I understand that too.
I wish I functioned in a world where I was always omniscient and like understood, like
shot right to the cosmos. You're done. Yeah, dude.
Like total awareness of self. But, you know, it's hard, you know, like nobody ever really explained to me how much guilt was involved in being a parent. it's like a constant, and I have to like, you know, I have to catch myself and say, okay, these are the decisions you're making and why, you know. And I think that those check-ins are important and that self-reflection is important. A lot of that happens for me when I'm out in the mountains and when I'm doing something that I love, and it opens up the space for me to kind of have that conversation with myself.
Okay. And what is that conversation like?
You know, why?
Why?
Why are you making these decisions? Mm-hmm. Let's examine how you're approaching this issue or problem. One thing I think is really useful is being conscious of the story that you're telling yourself. And it's like one of the great challenges of like being objective and having that awareness to self-examine. That's not about, you know, criticizing yourself or like judging yourself. It's like actually having the awareness to kind of look at, you know, why you're doing things and the choices that you're making.
Is your discovery process mostly an awareness of how you're speaking to yourself about yourself and other things? Or is it mostly written? Or is it talking out loud so you can with others so you can hear how you're formulating ideas, or all three. Those are the three big ones for me: writing, conversations with wise people, and then meditating.
Yes. Writing has not been one. I think that most of it is either through meditation or a form of whatever I...
Mindfulness. Yeah, whatever that might be.
Yeah, mindfulness. Someone once told me, the awareness of the awareness.
That's it.
Like when you're having the awareness of like this other awareness, you know, and oftentimes that awareness is like the stories that are happening. Mm-hmm. To be able to like look at it from up here and be like, oh, look at that. You know, I mean, it's so much of what, you know, that's some of what meditation is about, right? Like to be able to kind of look into that.
What does your practice look like? Is it like, I meditate when I'm climbing, I meditate when I'm setting up my gear, do you sit on a pillow or a side of a cliff and meditate? Like what does that practice look like? All of the above is cool too.
I don't know. I mean, I have done, you know, sitting meditation. My discipline for that has been laxing. I almost, and any sort of probably meditation guru would be like, bad, or maybe not bad because they wouldn't use that word, but right. It's that like I found certain aspects of it that I really appreciated that I felt like I could tap into. So I would be like, okay, this is a good moment to like get into that place. Let's take a look around here. Mm. You know? Mm. Sometimes it won't happen for a while and it'll happen and I'll be like, why have I not been doing this? Like, why have I not been having this conversation with myself, or like looking in the closet or whatever you want to call it. But for the longest time, and this is probably why I ended up doing what I did, like I couldn't find that place until I was in like a high stakes situation and survived something. And that's maybe part of, I guess you could call it the high. It's not one of those like acute adrenaline moments, but it's like after an expedition or where you just pushed so far and survived something that was like, it was so challenging. That's when I feel whole, and that's when I just live in that space for a while.
Where's the most spiritual place that you've been?
Oof. A physical space or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, physical. Because you've seen some places now.
Yeah. And spiritual, you know, obviously can mean a lot of different things. You know, where I can say like the one time I really had a truly out of body experience was being caught in this pretty big avalanche, not that far away from me, out here in the Tetons. And the moment right after, where I remember thinking, well, there was a lot that's kind of tied into that, but in what was happening while I was in the avalanche, but like in the moment after, just feeling like all the disorganized priorities in my mind just slotted into place. It was just like, you know, I don't know if that's exactly spiritual. I've had, you know, moments in the mountains where I was like, I was overwhelmed with emotion of the moment and the beauty of a moment. You know, certainly most recently, probably on this climb called Olvatana, and I was climbing with my climbing partner, Conrad. And it was actually the first expedition where it was just him and I, and we've been climbing together now for 15 years. And, this mountain was, you know, I consider it one of the greatest climbs I've ever done, if not the greatest, because we've been climbing together so long we hardly even talked on this climb. And it was a very difficult climb because we were just on the like we would look at each other and we wouldn't have to say it, you know. And there was a couple moments on that where we were sitting after a really long day and it kind of felt like we were on drugs, you know. We were just like, whoa, this is big and expansive, and you know, and it's also like sharing a moment like that is also just, it's extraordinary. It's one thing to have it on your own, but then to share it with someone is also deeply meaningful.
In a weird way, you shared a moment with and made popular what free souling is. You know, like you really, Alex didn't need any help. Alex Enoll didn't need any help. He didn't need an introduction, but you filmed that in a way that changed people. I know you've heard this plenty of times, but I hear it secondhand just because I work with some adventure athletes. And this is what I hear. Mike, did you see? I was like, yeah. And I cried. I couldn't put it down. I can't believe he went for that jump. And oh my God, how about his relationship? And like, it was like, I think you guys told the truth. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know from you is, so congratulations, you know, like, okay, you know, big time. But what I want to know is, I want to go to the morning of, it was like early morning of when it was go time. There's two moments I'm really curious about for you. The morning of when it's go time and the time of whatever it was when he asked you to be part of it. Mm-hmm. So let's go the morning. Let's actually start in reverse order and let's start in chronological. Okay. Let's start chronologically and go when he first said to you, hey, I want to do this thing. What do you think?
We had just finished a pretty successful run with Meru. There's a lot of people interested in what our next film was.
By the way, Jimmy, if folks haven't seen Meru, got to check that out too. Okay. Nice work. Okay. Way to get it in there. I was going to get it in there with you too.
I didn't mean to, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's good. You should
like
see it.
Free solo, you know, I mean, maybe.
Yeah. No. Okay.
It's, I won't even say that, but.
Wait, no, don't hold back now.
Well, I was just saying Meru for us is very personal. Obviously it tells a bit of my story to it too, but that was the first film Chai and I made together. So there's like a, you know, it's not, you don't love one child more than the other one, but that was our kind of our first child.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. But,
you know, that was a special film, still is a special film for us. And for me, but I had pitched a bunch of ideas. In the back of my mind, I had always thought Alex is a very interesting character. And Alex, among all of these people I have worked with, the greats, he was like one level up. Like, and I always say this, like among Alex's peer group of like the best of the best, I think it's safe to say even they feel like he's an anomaly in a peer group of anomalies. You know, like I was witnessing things that he was doing that were, even for someone who's very open-minded and seen a lot, was boggling my mind. Like there were things that were like kind of incomprehensible. So I let it slip at the end of this one meeting, and people have been kind of like, yeah, that's okay. And then it was immediately like, oh, that's the film.
Oh, you're gonna film Alex Enoll free soloing.
It was just a portrait biopic of.
Oh, it wasn't a doc at that point.
No, it was going to be a doc, but it was just going to be about Alex. So this is probably more information than you need to know, but I was really reluctant because I was like, I don't want to make a film about Alex free soloing. It's like extraordinarily dangerous. And of course it's like really stressful. That will be like horribly stressful. I don't want to deal with that.
Because wait, hold on, play that out, because I think you and I are shorthanding a lot. One is this is somebody you know, you care about, and he's extraordinary. And you filming him or presenting him with an idea to free solo something where there's, I don't know, whatever percentage chance, but
there's always a chance.
Yeah. And, but this one seems amplified.
Well, the thing is I didn't know he was going to free solo El Cap. It was just pitched as like a story, a film about Alex and his free soloing.
Okay. There you go.
In the process of kind of vetting the idea, my wife Chai was like, you know what, I need to spend some time with him and get to know him. And in the time that she spent with him, you know, she spent 2 days with him, and I was like, hey, what'd you think of Alex? She's like, he's very, very interesting. And by the way, he told me that he's gonna go free solo El Cap. Isn't that great? Because Chai isn't from the climbing world.
Oh my God, yeah.
And he didn't understand what that meant. And she said, that's a perfect like focal point for the film. And I just said, there's absolutely no way we can make that film. And the reason why is I didn't even know if it was ethically okay, because and Alex is wired in a way where external pressure, he's able to like kind of, you know,
it evaporates around him in some weird way.
Yeah, dissolve, you know, external pressure in a way that I'd never seen with anybody else either. But still, like introducing a camera to a situation, no matter who you are, even if you're Alex Honnold, changes the situation. And when the margins of success, that is the difference between life and death, are so thin that the idea of the camera being there or the pressure of a production around what he was doing was even for him, if he barely felt it, but if that was the amount that it took for things to go bad, I was like, I don't want to carry that responsibility. And funny enough, we let the cat out of the bag at a meeting with Nat Geo. And before we could even say anything, they were like, we'll finance that film. And I was like, actually, I'm not going to make that film. And I turned it down, like a fully financed film, for 6 months. Mm. And was like, not going to do it. And it was only after a conversation I had with John Krakauer, who's a good friend and mentor of mine, someone I really trust in terms of these kinds of decisions, because he obviously has a mind for it. And like any good mentor, he just said to me, he didn't give me an answer. He asked me 3 questions. He said, well, is he going to do it anyways? And I said, yeah. And he said, is there someone else do you think that would be, you know, better at telling the story, or and not just better at telling the story, but like in a good position, better position to tell the story? And I was like, no. I mean, I took Alex on his first international expedition. You know, I'd been working with him and climbing with him for 10 years. I knew him well. And then his last question was, well, do you trust him? And I said, I thought about it for a minute, but I was like, I do. And that's what allowed me to make the film, is that I did trust Alex, and I did trust that he would make the right decisions. He wouldn't go for the glory of the film. Like if he didn't feel like it was going to happen, sure as hell wasn't going to do it for the camera. You know,
that right there is a big deal, because the amount of pressure, one of the projects, I don't know if you and I talked about it at all before, but one of the projects I worked on, it was keeping me up at night. You know, I said yes. Mm-hmm. And I answered those 3 questions from somebody else. It was literally those questions.
Yeah.
And it was 2 people that asked me in 2 different times. And one of the questions was, it was a statement, one by the athlete, and this statement was, I'm doing it anyway, dude.
Yeah.
I'll be safer if you're involved. That was one that was like, oh Jesus, you know, that's heavy. And then the second was, and this is a soul searching question, is do you trust that he will make the right choice? And the choice is money. You called it glory. But when there's millions of dollars on the line expecting you to take a step, whatever that step is for Alex May was a grab or a leap.
Yeah.
And if you're not clear, because you don't want to let people down, you don't want to look bad, you don't want to be a chump, you don't fill in the blanks, whatever, whatever, whatever. Man, that's not a clear mind.
No.
And so you had
a very clear mind.
And so okay, you got through those three and you're like, yes, yes, yes. And then I didn't sleep well during the process. Like, did you sleep well?
There wasn't a day on 2.5 years of production where I didn't wake up thinking about the worst case scenario.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Did that mean that and on different days it was much deeper stress than others? But over time, you know, it was a process. And one of the things that I told the team early on that we reiterated over and over was that the only way we can think about this film is that the needs of this film will never be above Alex's needs. This is, you know, we couldn't even think that. It doesn't matter if you spent 5 days rigging and carried a 60-pound load and went up and down the ropes to get this shot. Like, and if he decides not to go up that day and you've done all that work, it's like, no big deal. Like, it's always about Alex and what he's trying to do. Because if you come at it with any other attitude, if something goes wrong, it's different, even though the actions are all the same. And we always live by that. But that's why my team was built up of professional climbers. You know, they understood exactly what I was talking about and how to minimize their presence and any sense of that pressure that, like, oh, you need to do this, you know, like some of us didn't even want them to do it, you know. It became about supporting Alex to achieve his dream. And that wasn't something I had to tell them. It was just the main cinematographer, Mikey Schaefer, longtime Yosemite guy, like has been climbing for years and years there, knows Alex. Same with Shane Lampe. They've climbed together for years and years. Like this was, it was like a team effort to support him achieving his dream. And really, it was about that. It was about Alex achieving his dream. If we make a great film, great. But that's like totally secondary at this point, you know?
Is your philosophy for when you film is to be the hand that leaves no trace? You know, what's the Zen koan? The hand that leaves the pond without a trace? Is that what you're trying to do?
I mean, in a perfect world, and it's not a perfect world, sure.
Okay. You know,
I mean, there are some scenes that are somewhat constructed, you know, it's like, or at least not constructed, but we're like, oh, if you're going to do that, can we hold for this one day for you to do that? Because then we'll be better prepared to film it. But like, you know, a lot of the scenes though, in the film that make it, and that's why you shoot 800 hours. We had 800 hours of film and it gets whittled down to 90 minutes. You have to film that much, especially the verite, like the in the moment filming, to get these little moments of gold. So like we're filming all the time, all day, every day in his van. But that moment, there's a moment when he's with Sonny and he's thinking about free soloing El Cap the next day and he hasn't told her. And she said, well, who are you climbing with tomorrow? Oh, I don't know. Peter? No. And in that moment, you see in her face that she's discovering in that moment that he is thinking about free soloing El Cap. Like in those moments, yes, we're trying to be the hand that, you know, leaves the pond just, without any ripples, you know. It's like verite filming is a lot like also photojournalism, like deep photojournalism, where you are there present for so long that you disappear. And the best, truly honest, authentic moments come from, you know, our verite DP, Claire Popkin, disappearing and capturing that moment and capturing it beautifully. So in that sense, yes, that's kind of like the ideal, you know, scenario where you're now gone and life is unfolding in front of you and you happen to capture it.
So that moment when he says, "It's on." How do you ready yourself for that? Or was you just like, it was in flight, let's go, let's catch up, because there was a moment where he just
it's a funny story, because we knew it was coming. Well, we thought it was coming twice. Like, there was that time when he goes and attempts it and he turns around. In a lot of ways, that was an incredible dry run,
because right.
We understood what it felt like.
For you.
Yes. And when something like that happens, and you get to, like, because he didn't do it, you get to come back and like debrief it in your mind and with your team. It's like all the different things that I hadn't thought about became very clear. And I was like, oh, okay, if he goes for it, this is how we're going to do it, just logistically and that kind of thing. But he comes back the next year. He is now in like beast mode. I mean, just even like looking at him physically, you're like, this is, you know, he's on. And Sonny left because he kind of knew that it might be sometime this week, upcoming week. We're hanging out at a friend's place and he's stretching and I'm stretching, and I kind of knew it was soon. But it was 5 o'clock at night in the evening. And I was like, well, he's not going for it tomorrow because it's 5 o'clock and he hasn't said anything. And one of the rules is that we were never, ever allowed to ask, when do you go?
Do it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
Too much. So that was a rule. And so I'm stretching. I'm like, it's 5 o'clock. So I look over at my DP and I'm like, hey, let's go climbing tomorrow. And Alex perks up and he's like, wait. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I'm thinking about doing some scrambling tomorrow. He calls it. Scrambling is like when you're climbing on, like, you know, low angle rocks. Like, he calls free soloing scrambling. And I was like, oh yeah. And he's like, yeah, I'm thinking about scrambling tomorrow. I was like, okay. And that week I had been getting people into position, ready to like move if anything happened. And so I just sat there and I stretched for 45 more minutes. And he just looked at me and he's like, don't you have to go somewhere? And I was like, ah, no, the sun's still on the east ledges. I'm going to wait till it's a little cooler. And I just made it seem super casual. But the amount of work that needed to be done to get everybody in position and all the camera equipment and everything lined up, I mean, it was significant. But we've also been working for 2.5 years. And so I finally get up and I walk out of the room and I put the word out. And we call him, his code name is Bambi, because he's got these big brown eyes. And, you know, I was like, it's on. Like, Bambi is, you know.
Wait, hold on. So that 45 minute stretch, were you helping to down regulate? Were you helping to not be a big deal? Were you being, in some cases, like, you know, the horse that's not getting kind of wild, so the other horses don't get riled up, that type of calming ground? So you knew what you were doing.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
It was everything I could do to stay there and hang out and be chill and just make it seem like it ain't no thing.
This is
you gonna go tomorrow? That's cool. I'm going to keep stretching my hamstrings. Mm-hmm. And then I walked out the door, and then, you know, it's like deploying like the special ops teams, you know,
yeah,
it's like,
right. Yeah.
bam, going tomorrow. And then it was just like, you know, we rigged all night long. Most of my crew had only had a couple hours of sleep by the morning. But we had it planned out to a T, because throughout the last 2.5 years, we had figured out exactly what the best angles were, exactly where we were going to be, which were the critical pitches, how we were going to get there, exactly how much rope, so we didn't have to bring any extra rope. I mean, you're wrapping in with like sometimes 4 bundles of 200 foot ropes a person, because the route doesn't go up. So some people are over here, some people are over here. It's like, I mean, with all our camera equipment, by the time we're wrapping in with like full ropes, I mean, you could be looking at for sure 50, 60, 70 pounds, depending. You know, you're carrying all your food and water for the day. And you're wrapping like 1,000-1,500 feet down El Cap. And so, you know, always the hardest shot was the one in the middle, because you either had to go up 1,500 feet or you had to drop in 1,500 feet. So the middle shots, like the Monster off with those things, were like the boulder problem. I mean, they're really hard to get to. I mean, not anymore, because like I know how to get there in my sleep, but but like normally if you show up in El Cap and you're like, hey, I'm gonna wrap into the boulder problem, people would be like, whoa, that's hardcore or whatever. But you know, I mean, we were so dialed in.
Do you use mental imagery to prepare for climbs?
I do, but not like Alex. There was a period before he went and sold it that week. There was many days where he just sat in his van with like the door closed and was just visualizing. And he told me he would visualize, well, he would practice the moves, then he would practice them in the incorrect sequence. So in case he ever made a mistake, he knew how to get out of it. He would visualize it. He would visualize himself falling.
I know that you and I spoke about this, but he and I did an interview about this, and I loved that he said that, because there's such a weird taboo that is not held up by science. Like, you know, like if you see it, you're manifesting it. It's bullshit. That's not how it works. And people are so afraid to see something bad or something negative. No, how about see how you're going to respond to a challenging situation? How about that?
That's exactly. He became comfortable with it.
That's exactly. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that you're inviting it. It just means that you've got
solutions. He was like, oh, this solutions. Is what I feel like to fall. And then he would just examine it and like, and so his visualization process, you know, I can't really say exactly what it was, but I mean, it's very, very intense.
You know what I didn't ask him? I didn't ask him, eyes closed or open. I'm assuming closed. Most people do. But did you ever catch him doing it? And the reason I'm asking is because sometimes people do imagery and they're moving, slight movements going through it, you know, and some people are just like completely, it looks like they're just sleeping.
Yeah, I never saw, I just knew. I'd be like, wow, he's been in there for days. What he was like doing.
Yeah.
Or he might have even told me. He's like, oh, I need to think, you know, like he almost knew where all the cruxes were. And so he was going through those. But yes, I mean, I definitely visualize for skiing or climbing. On expeditions, I visualize, you know, what certain things might be or feel like, and kind of get ahead of it in a way.
So when you're on the edge of a mountain and you're on your expedition or you're on somebody else's expedition and you're filming, whatever it might be, where do you know that you could make a mistake? Is it, I'm tired, I'm fatigued, let's go forward. I'm tired, I'm fatigued, I don't want to go. Where do you make your mistakes?
Usually, and this isn't just for me, but like the mistakes happen often in benign situations.
Okay.
That have big consequences where you don't feel, when you're focused on something that's really hard and potentially dangerous, that's not usually where it happens. it's the moments before, the moments after, you're too comfortable. That's when things happen. So there's a certain knowing that you kind of have to constantly be on, because you're like, oh, this is a moment where you don't think anything's going to happen. Don't let anything happen. Then of course there are those moments where fatigue, where you've just done 24 hours and you're rappelling. That's why most accidents in the mountains happen when you're descending. And also because there's a lot of times when you're disconnecting the rope, putting it back in, disconnecting the rope, when you're rappelling. So we like sing a song, like don't rappel off the end of your rope song. You know, it's like you kind of almost joke about it. It's kind of morbid, but you're just like, don't wrap off the end of your rope. You know, like they'll be wrapping, your friend will be next to you. They're wrapping first. You go next, you look at them, you're like, don't wrap off the end of your rope, bud. You know, like, and it's like, yep, won't wrap off the end of my rope. And you know, you're double checking their systems. They're double checking your systems. Oddly, it seems that it's much easier to feel like a responsibility to check somebody else's systems, because you're less like, you're like, oh, I'm in charge of their safety, so I'm going to do it right. Mm. And sometimes you're a little bit more lax about yourself. I'm not saying like I do that intentionally, but like, that's just the case. So you're always double checking theirs, that your partner is your responsibility. They're checking yours, you know? But yes, there's definitely moments when you're like, okay, we're right at the edge. We're all wasted, like totally smoked. And you can tell.
And just for clarity, you're not talking about drugs. You're talking about exhausted.
So destroyed where there's this feeling that starts to happen where it's like, I don't even really care.
I know it. Yeah.
And you're like, I don't really care if I go off the end of this rope. It's not literally like that, but there's this feeling where you're like, I'm you know, it's like you're so past your threshold of, you know, keeping it together. And it's been so intense for so long, it just starts like you just can't really dig it out of yourself anymore. You're like, okay,
there's a period, like I observed this, or someone taught it to me, I can't remember, but post projects, when we're doing a bunch of projects with Red Bull, it was quite apparent the 2-week window after something that was really game shifting, that's where people would find themselves getting hurt. So they did the big thing, whatever it was. Then 2 weeks later, I don't know, they're ripping down the freeway on their motorcycle, thinking they're invincible.
Yeah.
You know, or not wearing their seatbelt or something, you know, it's like, that's like where things
survive that, whatever. None of it really.
Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I could go on with sharing stories and learning from you. And I just want to say thank you for making a difference in so many people in their lives, of understanding risk management, risk taking, authenticity, being true, and being a beacon for that calibration of what's true and what's pure, and not only being about it, but capturing it. And so,
thank you for saying that. I can only hope. Yeah. I live inside my own bubble. So
No, I've heard it a lot about you and your work. And so, and I've experienced it as well. Like, I love watching your work. And so, I just want to say thank you. And where's a place people can find you? Download Meru.com. Like, what do you want? You know, like, what are we doing?
Meru's on Amazon. Free Solo is on Disney Plus. We have quite a few films coming out shortly, and a couple series that are also coming out in this next year and following years. So keep an eye out for those. We're really excited about them. We have 3 feature documentaries that are coming out. We have 3 new series that are coming out. But you know, my Instagram handle is just jimmychin.com. But otherwise, Yeah, I hope that people are inspired by the work and moved by the work and have a shift in perspective on the human condition and human potential. And I love this conversation. So thank you for having me.
Oh, dude, I can't wait to go surfing again with you. That was honestly, that was a highlight of last year. Like, no joke.
Yeah,
seriously. I know both of us have done some cool shit, but that was a highlight. You know, like everything about it just was magical. And yeah, hopefully we get to do that again soon.
I hope so too.
All right, brother. Take care.
All right. Cheers.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.